presentation based on my experiences from Kenya. In Kenya, Kenya is a country of about 35 million people. And about 3 years ago, when we had the demographic health survey in Kenya, what was very clear was that about what was reported was about 30% of the women experiencing between 14 and 24 years experiencing sexual violence in their lifetime, and about 15% in the previous year. Now, we all know that reports from DHSS and other, you know, sort of mass surveys are often underreported. And this was the first time it was done when the gender-based violence model was included. So really, I'm coming from a background where, one, sexual violence has always been considered a very private issue, not to be talked about, and two, where the health sector has had no engagement with sexual violence as an issue. And I'll be talking about what we did and where we are coming from. Liverpool VCT Care and Treatment is an NGO, and we are involved in HIV prevention and care. And so one of the things that we do is about annually we provide counseling and testing for about a quarter of a million Kenyans. One of the things that increasingly has become an issue, or became an issue when we started this work in 2003, was the question of a lot of clients coming to VCT saying, I've been raped. VCT is voluntary counseling and testing. I have been raped. I want to know my HIV status. So the question of whether this happened yesterday or a year ago or 2 years ago was still very fuzzy, and we were having health providers and counselors not sure what to do. We're also having a lot of people reporting and presenting at health facilities, but often preferred not to be discussing or to be saying that what they're presenting for is sexual violence. More often than not, people prefer that is not documented, but that they're seen by a private provider. So what we did was to try and look at the situation analysis to try and see really what sort of problem are we talking about in the context of HIV. What are we saying we need to do? To what extent can we begin to leverage the resources that are there to address this issue that seemingly seems to be quite under, you know, sort of discussed under the table? And so we did a diagnosis, which was a situation analysis, looking at perceptions of sexual violence, an intervention where we designed and implemented a standard of care, and finally we did an evaluation. Okay. In the perception, I won't really go through the details, but why we thought about looking at perception was really because we rationalized that sexual violence is impacted on by social perceptions, and the uptake and delivery, which were the evaluation measures, the outcomes that we were looking at, we thought that they would be impacted on by social perceptions. So we really wanted to understand what the perceptions were, and then also establish the priorities in terms of from a policy, practice, and service delivery perspective. Then, thank you. Just talking about some of the findings, one of the things that was very interesting is around the fuzzy boundaries between post-coercion and consent. But one of the things that was clear was that there is this imagination that when women say no to sex, they actually mean yes. I'm sure that many of us have heard that little quote. And what was disturbing is that people do believe it. And it is not only believed by men, women also do believe it. And I think that's already problematic in the way in which we begin to think about sexual violence. The other thing was about health providers. We are saying health providers should be providing services. Health providers had challenges initiating counseling, initiating risk reduction. If you're talking about providing HIV testing and counseling in the context of sexual violence, you're talking about wanting to do a risk assessment. You know, prior risk, prior sexual risk, prior sexual consensual risk. So health providers had difficulties beginning to have that sort of discussion with someone who is not presented for VCT or for counseling and testing, but for someone who has just been raped and violated. And I think there was a question of documentation, or history was also very, very poor. This actually exemplifies some of the challenges and the issues around stigma, around labeling, and around the very, very fuzzy boundaries and between forced consent and coercion, or you know, that spectrum and how clear it is. And this particular, you know, question is a young girl who says, do I accept to be labeled as rape, or should I give in? And you question, is this coercion? Is this not coercion? Is it force? Is it consent? Where does this sort of situation lie? And more importantly, as I move on with my presentation, is for us to begin to think, what does it mean for health service delivery? Will this person come to the health facility? And if they do come to the health facility today, tomorrow, and the day after, what sort of service are we saying we need to be able to provide them? The next thing was around service delivery, was around policy. There was absolutely no regulatory framework, standards, documentation, coordination, and service delivery was very inconsistent. Emergency contraception was not always provided. We did this in 3 district hospitals, one in the east of Kenya, one in the west of Kenya, and one in the middle of Kenya, one peri-urban, one coastal, highly tourism area, and the other was totally a very rural sort of district health center, very small service delivery facility. But it was very consistent that there was inconsistency in service delivery. HIV prevention, post-exposure prophylaxis was certainly not provided, and counseling was often based on VCT because that was the most developed form of counseling we had then, and there were limited capacities among providers, and more importantly was that survivors were being asked to pay, and if they didn't have money to pay for user charges that are normally paid for, then it was not impossible for them to be turned down and not deliver the service. So what did we do? With those presentations, we needed to be able to look at how do we design and develop an intervention? How do we actually implement a standard of care? And what we did was we started with stakeholder consultations, and the DHMTs, which are the district health management teams in Kenya, are the focal point for management of resources and for decision making at the district level, which is the primary planning unit within the health care system. Then we also had, we developed what we call the post-rape care algorithm, where we had a consensus on standards, what would be minimum standard, the protocols that would be used, procedures for service delivery and client flow. And then we mutually defined our outcomes, and finally, more importantly, we had targeted the health provider training, because health providers, and it was based in 2 perspectives. One was clinical service providers, and the other was around counselors, where counselors were to provide additional ongoing care. In delivering the standard of care, we looked at where survivors were supposed to. This was basically the algorithm. They presented at casualty, they were given emergency management, then they were sent for counseling. Now, one of the things that was very clear for us was that trying to provide services in a standalone or in a one-stop facility where the health provider comes to the survivor is not feasible, it's not practical in our system, in our health systems. So we needed to integrate service delivery and the various services that were required within the healthcare system. And that the HIV care clinics is where management was done for 2 weeks and again for 4 weeks. And we also collected data, given that this was a study, to be able to understand the outcomes that we required to understand. So these were the clients that we saw. We saw obviously a very high proportion of women. But what was surprising, I think, is if you look at the I'm not sure that it's blue, purple, line right at the bottom there. That was the number of male clients we saw. And if you notice, there were also older male clients, which was quite surprising for us, because we, in the public domain, men do not come to the health facility. And if they do, it's often when there is totally, they're totally traumatized and really do require services. I think in terms of uptake, this is what we had. The age range, the median age was about 16.5, but the age range, the youngest was 16 months that we saw, and the oldest was 1 or 2 years. Both of those were female. Most children knew the perpetrators, and again, the higher number of children. But also what was really interesting was that all of the late presentations, and late was defined by a cutoff of 72 hours, that is presenting after 72 given the time-dependent nature of post-exposure prophylaxis and emergency contraception. In terms of delivery of care, we were able to, and this I think really for me to be able to highlight this is to show that even within that system, there are going to be losses in the client flow, because this is a health system where there's geographic layout, different service delivery points, and we were able, with a system available and in place, we were able to ensure that at least half of the survivors were able to get counseling and information, and at least three quarters were able to get most of the services required. However, we had a couple of challenges. One was the HIV test. 11% said no to HIV testing even when they did not know their HIV status and preferred not to access PEP than undertake HIV testing. Obviously, there are issues there around service delivery that we need to be thinking about, because we only gave HIV PEP to those who tested, accepted to test for HIV and tested HIV negative. And we lost quite a number to referral. And all of the people who are HIV positive at baseline were women. None of them were men. And again, we had the late presenters. But out of the people that finished the, that took PEP, there was only half of them eventually finished to the 28-day dose. And we lost quite a number in the client flow pathway. And finally, PEP completion it was more likely that those who completed PEP, that those who were provided counseling were more likely to complete PEP. And of course, we all know that PEP is not necessarily 100% effective, and we had one for completion. So really, what does this mean for us? Moving on, I think the first thing was trying to look at, if we're talking about implementing post-rape care services in resource-limited settings, what are the critical things we need to be thinking about? First is the acceptability of services by the local service providers. And it's really critical to be able to have discussions and hold consensus building processes around the implications of sexual violence, and not only the implications for the survivors, but the implications for the healthcare system. What we found we were able to do was always talk about the obvious risk between HIV and sexual violence, and then talk about what that would mean in terms of our of the healthcare facility, in terms of the care, the HIV care clinics. And that was a language that resonated with the service providers. Then we also looked at documentation. And finally is the question of training. The training that we focused on was very value-based, where we had clinicians as well as, not as much for the clinicians, but we did spend time getting clinicians to actually identify and look at their own values around sexual violence. When we talk about sexual violence and the fuzzy boundaries, what are the clinicians' own values and what do they mean for the clinicians on service delivery? I think that's very important when you begin to get people to question what is important for them. Then we also targeted, we also looked at, in the training courses, we also talked to clinicians about the importance of counseling. What we have found is that in a country like Kenya, we've got clinical care here, and we've got counseling care here, and we've got this big disconnect, even though the two things are really supposed to be able to focus on the same individual. And particularly given the HIV/AIDS context, the disconnect is really quite big. So we're able to show clinicians, actually, see, if you don't get counseling, it's highly likely that these people you're talking about are not going to finish the medicine that you want them to finish. I think that was really important in getting buy-in, because it was actually part of the health providers that we are then able to say, no, actually refer people in this direction and refer people in this direction. So my final slide is really say, what are the lessons learned and what are the lessons and opportunities for being able to implement post-rape care services in resource-limited settings. I think the first one is that you need to have a standard of care, and that it needs to be based on local health systems. I know that the WHO has a standard of care in the medical legal guidelines. However, some of the recommendations and that standard of care might not necessarily work. For instance, one-stop centers, while they ensure that the survivor does not then have to move from point to point, it's not practical, at least in my setting. And therefore, we need to be able to be thinking what is the minimum and what is practical. call. We need to have very targeted and value-based training for service providers. For the clinicians, we gave a three-day training that focused on medical legal issues that had a little bit of value, you know, evaluation around sexual violence. But for the counselors, we had a really long, detailed development of counselors to look at sexual violence, to examine their own values, but more importantly, to be able to provide ongoing care and treatment. Then there's the question that becomes very important. What do we do with those who are HIV positive at baseline? Because some of them actually do believe that they have got HIV from that exposure, that violent situation. When in this case we would know that they didn't, how do you reconcile that with people so that they are then able to move on? How do you ensure that you're getting positive prevention for survivors? And finally, we saw that in the very fuzzy boundaries, we are talking about chronic exposures. For instance, in that one court, to what extent will that girl be able to say no tomorrow to either that same person or another person? To what extent the question, what does that mean for her self-esteem? What does that mean for her ability to access care and treatment? But more importantly, I think, is what does it mean for the health provider if we are talking about the health care delivery? What does that mean? Should you then be giving PEP, on an ongoing basis? How do we do it? Should we give emergency contraception? What sort of counseling do we need? Should we have this standard, blanket covers all counseling? Or do we need to have more targeted approaches? And I think those are questions that everyone needs to be asking themselves. And then therein lies the question of the role of advocacy. What is the role of advocacy? What is the role of the rights? What is the role of prevention? Because I'm talking from a context where it has already happened. But what is the role of prevention in this context? And finally, counseling and follow-up key. In terms of applying the lessons for Kenya, what we've been able to do with this work is develop national guidelines on the medical management of sexual violence in collaboration with the Division of Reproductive Health. And we've had additional key issues emerge, issues of quality assurance, issues of linking documentation, which we did as a study, into the health management information system, and issues of costs. How do we scale up? How do we convince the Ministry of Health that this is scalable and that first of all it's required? And that number two, the next question that we got from the Ministry of Finance when the Division of Reproductive Health went to ask for money in this year's budget was, but how much does it cost? We don't know. So how do we begin to cost interventions in sexual violence, interventions in post-rape care, interventions in service delivery? And how do we cost them, given the dynamics around not being able to know who presents and who doesn't present and how many people will present? So those are questions that I think that we need to think about, we need to be answering, and there are opportunities for a lot of research, a lot of work, and for there as well challenges that we have to address from a continuum of prevention, treatment, and care. Thank you.
Since we have a couple of minutes in between these two presentations, I wanted to just see if there are any questions for either Angela or Nduku at this point that folks want to bring up. Yes. Okay. I'm going to repeat the question. I'm going to ask Angela to come to the podium to answer. So the question was, how do you monitor exposure to gender-based violence in the community? You mentioned one use of the snowball method where you ask one individual and to identify someone else that he or she knows.
That's an excellent question, but I think it's more of a question for partners with whom we work on the ground. The work of Human Rights Watch is usually in conjunction with those partners to go in and document violations of rights, care, or rape itself, etc. So we wouldn't be actually involved in the monitoring systems. But one of those could be, like, with the recommendations on some of those reports, is to make sure that people who are working in armed conflict or conflict settings, et cetera, try to keep records, try to inform peacekeepers, for example, who are supposed to be protecting all civilians about safety measures, precautions, et cetera. That's probably the clearest, shortest answer I could give you, but I would refer you to those reports because I think there are some more detailed recommendations that could better answer your question.
Kirsten, could you come to the podium just so we can...
Kirsten, I know I haven't spoken yet, but I do have, I also like that I have a chance to work with the WHO that came out with a recent report on violence against women, and one of the components of that was exactly that question, and they have within that, and you just go to WHO, and I'm sorry I don't have the web link with me right now, but they have an ethical guideline in terms of doing this research, and they have very specific strategies for how to ask these questions. So I know, for instance, and then they've got measures of what's the differential you get when you ask it directly, and what are the ethics around asking when you don't have services to provide, or when you're in the house where other family may hear the answer. And then also using, they would, one of the strategies, again, was to provide a sheet of paper with a, I think it was literally like a smiley face or a frowny face, and they could mark what was the, you know, their feeling at the question, and they also then document what the sort of differential response is well. So I think that would be a real good source for you.
Yeah, and I believe that website is who.srvi.org. I think that's the WHO Sexual Violence Research Initiative. Pardon? SVRI.org. It's in the back, and then down there. So the question was regarding confidentiality and working with providers to ensure that confidentiality in the service delivery setting, correct?
Okay, thank you. We did a couple of things. One, that was part of the training around privacy, confidentiality, what does it mean? And it was part of getting people to evaluate within themselves what, if they were in the same experience, what that would mean for them. And often that kind of coming back from me, what people thinking in terms of what sort of services we could provide. That said and done, at the casualty or the emergency departments where people come in to access services and get services, that was a place where that became a point of presentation, identified as a point of presentation for the health facility. Because there were various service delivery points that a survivor had to access, what was agreed on in all the health facilities was that there would be, at the casualty, survivors would be given a card with the words PEP on it. Often there's only two groups in the, from a policy perspective in Kenya where PEP is delivered, that's occupational exposure for survivors. But with the words PEP on it, and that meant that then whenever they went to any of the various service delivery points, they did not have to queue. They went directly through the triage system, and they were just told, when you go there, just present this. Don't worry about the queue, present this. And because that was part of the training for the health providers, not only at service delivery points, but everyone knows, even now, that, you know, a card with the word PEP on it is a priority, and so they then get priority treatment at the lab, in counseling, as well as in the HIV care clinic.
Okay, Corey, and then, yes. I had that question as well.
do any community campaigns or public health information campaigns? No, not at that time, not when we were doing the study. What we did was we integrated messages in pastoral care in very sort of clarified, sort of almost controlled ways during the study period in the messaging for the waiting rooms, where they have the waiting rooms and they have all of this messaging that public health nurses give. So it was integrated there. And the other place was that there were little booklets that we gave out that I can avail in soft copy to Virginia, that we gave out that said, you know, what is rape, what is sexual violence, what is emergency contraception, what do you need to have, what are your rights in the health section, what are your rights in the police station, and those were available at the various service delivery points, so I guess people just picked in and walked away with them. So all we had was the numbers that people took, but we didn't know who took and why, because they were quite open to the public. But afterwards, yes, there's now a national sort of campaign that is being put together around zero tolerance to sexual violence, and a concurrent campaign in a couple of the places where there are services, because so far the Ministry of Health has scaled up to about 16 health facilities now, and I'm aiming to do another 10 by end of next year. So you sort of mentioned the gender issues as well as the need to put more attention to prevention. And I'm not sure if it's an observation or if you require an answer, because I totally agree with you that it's unclear, it's very fuzzy, and again, prevention is something that somebody needs to do. It's just that for me, from where I come from as an organization, we're into, you know, sort of health facility, strengthening policy, strengthening and service delivery and care. Okay, thanks for the question. What you've asked is whether we provide, in addition to HIV counseling, any other type of counseling. The answer is yes. The way the counseling protocol reads is that it starts off with focusing on trauma, crisis prevention, and where possible families are asked are involved into the program. And we also then, HIV testing is actually sort of comes way after the original interaction. And so in my experience, what I have found is that it ends up taking much longer than the standard trauma counseling program and the standard HIV counseling program, because then you bring the two aspects together. And also you're talking about consensual sex, or someone who's already in a chaotic situation in terms of the sexual relationship, then you're also trying to bring in the whole question of consensual HIV risk. So it's always a very tricky area to negotiate, and particularly amongst adolescents. I think that is the hardest area, and from my own discussions with counselors, to negotiate. Yes, but yes, we are doing it. Though there is a gap in terms of long-term treatment, more often than not, after the first month of PrEP, we normally lose people. They just don't come back to the health facility, so we don't get a chance for ongoing treatment, and that's still a gap.
Well, the question is, does international human rights law define coercion? Or does it just in human rights context? That's an excellent question, and I'm going to say I don't really know how to answer that question. I don't know if in the sexual research, sexual violence research initiatives, if there are definitions of coercion and how they're managing that. That's a very good question. I don't really know exactly how to answer that. Yeah, we don't, for example, we don't interview victims of coercion, per se. Coercion would lead to another manifested violation, I suppose. But I don't want to misspeak, so if you come to me afterwards, I'd be happy to look up that information and get back to you.
Might be useful to look at the work done by Rachel Jukes in South Africa around issues of coercion.